All right, so continuing in Yale 2011, we have a couple special guests. We're going to do a dual interview, which was, of course, Alan's idea here. And Alan Wurzbrock, people know him from JavaScript and Smalltalk. You've been on Channel 9 several times. Thanks again for coming on.
Sure, happy to be here.
Excellent, man. And you're a new face.
Yeah, my name's Rob Manson.
Absolutely, man. And your talk was very interesting.
Cool.
So what I want to do is set some context for people. So I think the best way to do that would be to talk about your talk and the concepts there, and then Alan can do the same, and then we can start the fun dialogue.
Sure. Okay. So my talk title was Augmented Reality is the User Interface for Pervasive Computing, but that's a pretty technical thing. So the sort of pitch was that with pervasive computing, all of the technology dissolves into the background, and so you're left with all of these devices that don't have a physical interface. And what you really need is some other way of accessing that. And at the moment, that's smartphones and mobile devices. But as we get into a more immersive computing experience, using augmented reality to just overlay interfaces and representations on top of those devices is seems like a natural extension.
Interesting. Very interesting. What do you think of that, Alan?
Well, it's exactly what I foresee happening. So So as people who've seen me talk before know, I've been working on the evolution of JavaScript for a number of years and the development of new future versions of the JavaScript standard, and that leads me to think a lot about the broader web platform in general and where it's going and how it's going, which has led me to think about just sort of the nature of evolution of computing. And something I noticed over the last years is people talking a lot about the concept of post-PC computing and makes me think, well, what, and that there's a post-PC computing era, which made me, started me thinking about, well, post-PC is not very descriptive of what's coming next. If that's how we describe the next era of computing, then what we call the PC era should be the post-mainframe era, and and we're then be entering the post-post-mainframe era, none of which tells us anything. So,
okay.
So as I looked at kind of the evolution of computing, and I looked at what PCs doing and what it meant to have a PC era, sort of the thing that stood out to me that's likely what we're moving towards as the next era of computing is what I've been labeling ambient computing, but some people would call it pervasive computing or ubiquitous computing. At some point here, we'll settle on a common term and stuff, but the really idea is in the world of PCs, a PC was a place, and a person would go to that place and work on a, some specific task. They'd do email, they would work on a spreadsheet, they might browse the web, but it was a very task-oriented thing, and it was computers empowering people to do specific things. What we're moving into now, I think, is a world where computing is simply empowering and enhancing the entire environment we live within. We don't go to a computer to do things. We're interacting with computer-augmented devices, and it's changing the way we live our entire lives. Things as simple as here I am in a strange city in a whole different half of the world I've never been to before. How do I find my way around? Well, I have a little device I pull out, and it shows me exactly where I am and what time it is here and how to get to the site I want to see. And that's just one small example of a really a computing augmented world. So the sort of what Rob is describing to me is has many concrete details of the vision of what that world is like. So where my focus, I've been thinking about what's the platform that people are going to build this ambient computing world upon, and how do things like web technologies fit into that. I think Rob is describing what it's really going to be like to live in that world, what sorts of applications, if you will, or what sort of devices people are going to be building. And so I saw just a lot of synergy between, you know, what I was talking about and what he talked about.
So now, Rob, I want to ask you, when I think of the term augmented reality, besides maybe a Saturday night that's gone on too long, but when I think about that as sort of the, as you were saying, like I'm holding up my phone, Mm-hmm. I'm pointing at you, and I'm turning you into something else.
Yeah.
Or I'm interleaving something on top of you, and all of a sudden, you know, oh yeah, this is who this person is. I recognize you. Mm-hmm. I understand you. Or I pointed at a swath of area, and it says that's where your restaurant is, and that little thing is pointing me to it. Or so, what do you mean by augmented reality?
There's in terms of the technology itself, like it's a real mouthful. It's quite a bad term, and I'll be glad when we move on from it.
Great.
There's two main flavors for augmented reality. There's locative-based AR, which is the sort of thing that you were really describing there, and the main sort of players are Layer or Wikichu, those sorts of mobile applications. There's also a more computer vision-focused AR, which is around the camera actually recognizing the images that it sees, processing those and working out orientation and space, those sorts of things. Mm. And again, some of those applications I mentioned provide that as well. The Wikichu definition of augmented reality is, I think, to quote it, like a live direct or indirect video view with computer imagery mapped on top of it.
Sure.
It's a bit visually focused. I think we're really sort of underrating the power of audio. And I also think it's a little bit, it's still quite naive. We're still describing it as just an immersive experience where you overlay things. Whereas for me, reality really happens in your mind. And if you look at people like Thad Starner, they've been wearing wearable computers for 20 years. He doesn't have a fully immersive display. He's got a small monocular display. He has a complete track of every conversation he's had with you, where he's been at the time. And so he's augmenting his reality through augmented cognition. So I think there's a much broader discussion to be had, but we're just really on the beginning of it.
Interesting. Now, what do you think about the platform futures?
Well, I really like the way that Alan did the analysis of the they weren't generations, but the
era.
Because it was around the societal impact rather than the technology itself. And I definitely think the web is the platform. So I see AR as the evolution of the web, this sensor-aware, contextually aware web, because all the native fragmented environments, it's just too hard and expensive to keep developing for all of those environments.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and just to fill in, since I only told half the story, I mean, my story was really that we're entering the third era of computing. The first era was corporate computings, and the role of computers was really to help large organizations be more effective. Personal computing came along, and now the role of computer was to help individuals do tasks more effectively, and now we're going to an era where computers are augmenting the reality we live within, basically, and stuff.
Yeah.
I guess one thing I want to point out is I think that vision of this really computer augmented environment, this is a long term vision. I mean, we're seeing major pieces of it, more pieces emerge every year, but when people like you talk about, you know, this really immersive experience, we're probably talking 20 years in the future, in the same way that it took 20 years from the first personal computers, where you had visionaries like Alan Kay and Ted Nielsen describing what personal computing could be like, to when, where we got to something was very close to those visions and stuff. And so where I see is we're at the beginning of this stage, and so all sorts of things that we've taken for granted for the last 30 years, we have to start reconsidering. And we're building a new world of computing, new style of applications. There's a new vision we're shooting for. What sorts of platforms, what sorts of technologies, what are going to get us there and stuff.
Understood. So, I mean, that's a good question. And what do you think?
In terms of technologies and platforms?
Yeah, that are going to get us there.
Yeah, what do you need? In one sense, I'm saying you got the vision.
Yep.
So what do we need to build your vision?
I've got a list here. I think we're headed on the right track. I think, obviously, the mobile devices are a stepping stone. So the small mobile device is a keyhole sort of experience for that at the moment. Moving on to the tablets, that's more of a window onto the world. I think there's some great sort of immersive experiences. Vuzix already shipped some good sort of consumer-level devices, and there's some good monocular displays starting to ship in Japan. So those are stepping stones. I think I think that technology is going to roll out fairly seamlessly. There's a trajectory there for it. A lot of the standards are sort of aligning around that. For me, more of the challenges around the social impacts, the privacy, and there's just no framework for a lot of this. Mm-hmm. Who controls virtual space at the moment?
Sure.
The changes in our social interactions. So if you're, it's not just about what's overlaid, but what you're connected to. Mm. At the moment, your sense of embodiment is this feedback loop of, I can see my hand, I can tell that when I move my hand, my thought controls that, and by seeing it and then getting that feedback loop, I feel embodied in my experience. Mm. There's a thing called a rubber hand illusion by Ramachandran, and you can fool people by putting a rubber hand in place of where their normal hand is. If you stroke it, after a while, people start to project onto that and believe that the rubber hand is their own. Hmm. And you can really fool people's body image into adopting artificial objects as part of their perception of themselves. So I think once you use augmented reality and connect your streams with other people, you can really change your perception of where you are and who you are. Hmm. Now, I think we're just not even mentally prepared for that sort of change.
No. I don't want Avatar, man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's very similar to that, yeah.
I mean, Avatar would be fun for a game.
Yep.
I mean, the gaming industry would just, this would be tremendous.
Yep.
To be able to actually be in the context of the game that you're playing. You mentioned the embodiment word,
yep.
And there was actually a talk at PDC 10 from one of the Microsoft researchers in our technical leaders track. And basically, the idea is essentially already what you've sort of been talking about, was that the next wave of computing will be your glasses. So Alan sees me, he's wearing these glasses. The glasses tell him, that's Charles, in case you forgot. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, Charles, how you doing? And the last time you saw him was at Yale 2011 in Melbourne. Hey, yeah, I remember you in Melbourne. That's going to come. And you said it's already almost here.
Yeah, there's some great
demo. Yeah, that's...
So now where does the web, like JavaScript platform, fit into that model? Does it have to?
Well, so... It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to, but I think there's a good chance it will. So my talk here was titled something like "The Browser is a Transitional Technology."
Yes.
Right? The browser is a very important technology, but it's part of the transition from the PC era to the ambient computing era and stuff. There are many aspects of using a browser that are very much like ambient computing. You have the entire web of information available through it and stuff. People can build applications and it will run on any web browser. It doesn't just run on a particular platform and such. So those are all very important aspects of the web environment. But the browser itself is a PC application. Mm-hmm. And we already see people for mobile devices, phones, and tablets are building so-called apps, which... if you actually look at how they're implemented, they're just using browser technologies, HTML5 technology, but instead of being wrapped in the skin of a browser, they're wrapped in the skin of a single purpose application. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think how the browser over the long run is likely to impact the computing world is that as we have all these disparate devices, literally hundreds and thousands of devices react with every day. Well, we still want, I want my data, the applications I use, the things I do, to be available with whatever device I'm most closely interacting with. And so essentially I want the same code, the same data to work everywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, the browser already does that, right? So I think the browser application platform, if you will, the HTML5 platform, has a good chance of becoming the common application platform that will be embedded in every device.
Interesting. Like your glasses.
Like my glasses, for example.
Okay, interesting. And your sunglasses or your shirt or...
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and your camera and the thermostat over there and probably the lights up there and maybe my shoes, who knows? It's
interesting, man.
I think related to the point Alan made before about... you're not going to your computer anymore, your desktop computer. That distance is a really important thing. That's the thing with the web browser, the distance between it and the network was zero because it's, it's connected to the network. Didn't really make sense without the network. As we move to these devices, so now I don't go to my My computer's in my pocket, my phone, and it follows me around. So it's gone from it being the center of origin that I rotate around to it rotating around me. And then once you move into the sort of glasses space, it's collapsed even further, so the distance is smaller. I think what you're saying about the browser being a PC app, that's the same thing again, but within the environment. You have to go to an application. But once it's inside your glasses or something like that, it's just there all the time. The distance between you and the network is getting smaller and smaller.
Right. Now, there will always be, I think, applications that are about browsing and searching and discovering. I mean, that is an activity you do, and there are tools to help humans do that. But the browser itself was, like I say, this place where you had to go to do that. In the future, you'll be able to do that anywhere.
Sure.
So that's simply one application, and it's so when I talk about the browser platform being everywhere, I really mean the platform that application developers use to create and deploy their applications on. So those are the people I most directly work with and stuff. How are people going to build their applications? What technologies? How do they deploy them and stuff? And how's that going to change as things evolve?
So is there going to need to be like an augmented reality standard?
Yes. So we're already working on that. So I'm co-founder of a sort of community called ARStandards.org, and so we have somewhere between 2 and 4 international workshops a year, and we're up to about our fourth or so. The last one was in Basel in Switzerland. There's a lot of progress. So we're engaged with the W3C, OGC, Kronos, all those sorts of people, and I think there is a real need for that standardization.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's hope that it can move pretty fast.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I was going to say, so your augmented reality standard could well be simply the web standards, right? And as a matter of fact, right now there's a lot going on. I mentioned the idea of squeezing the browser down to just its bare essentials and operating systems through their bare essentials. So you have a platform that really just has what's there to run a web-style application. And when that's on a device, part of what you need there is the APIs that allow you to access all the sensors of the device. So if you think about it, like building a phone simply out of a web browser technology, well, that phone has to be able to access the accelerometers and has to be able to access the radials and has to be able to deal with touch. And there's lots of activity right now going on in the web standards area to fill out that set of web APIs. Because if you look at a phone, and there's in my presentation I used today, I had a slide. If you look at all the capabilities in a 2011 phone, about half the sensors there are web APIs that you can use from a browser, and about half there aren't. And so that other half we need to complete the APIs and standardize them. So you can do everything those devices, and then there are other capabilities, I'm sure, for other sorts of devices beyond just what a phone does that need to be developed.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's an interesting time because it's so close that we've created a sort of an R&D site called isweb3here.com. And so we think this new bundle of sensor APIs is the next stage of the web. Web 2, Web 3, they're really sort of horrible terms, but a lot of people thought Web 3 was semantic technology, but I don't think it was enough of a structural change. I think the sensor-driven things make it a structural change. But it's at the point where you can write a test harness and say, do any of the browsers that access the site have all of the components available? So you go to it, and it's just got a bunch of X's and ticks for what it passes. Mm-hmm. And so far, no browser completely passes all of them, but each month we're getting closer and closer. So it's at the point where within a few months, I think that will be a valid working platform.
In terms of what we already have on the client for rendering, we have very sophisticated and powerful ways to build these immersive UIs. They're not based on the web technologies. They're native technologies running on a GPU. And so we already have a lot of that core code running and existing today. Why should we replace that with web? Because web can connect seamlessly to the web. Talk to me about that. So this is my question. I'm going to try to frame it intelligently. Did I do it?
Sure. Well, first, let me start by saying part of these platforms we're building today include GPUs. And so when we talk about the web platform, the web application platform being on a device, we're assuming the device has a GPU, and that when the web platform does its rendering, it's using the GPU to do that. And for higher order, more complex things, I think you did some demos. I didn't do a demo, but I did something very similar in terms of video rendering in JavaScript. And the hard work for that, and for the things you show, if not today, then next year are going to be done by the GPU. And there's considerable work. You talked about various emerging technologies that may become web standards that are specifically addressing how do you exploit GPU-type capabilities in a web-style application.
Yeah, and in terms of the augmented reality, you can, I think what's important about that is the adoption or the user base. So when AR was first kind of popularized, Billinghurst and Cato released a toolkit called AR Toolkit. It was a C and C++ set of libraries. It was great, an excellent step forward, but you had to build applications and deploy them for specific platforms. In about 2009, Sakusha from Japan ported that set of libraries to ActionScript 3 as another step forward. And it made a massive adoption burst because people could just access it from any Flash-enabled browser, but it was still sort of plug-in based and still clunky. Now that's been ported to JavaScript, and if you look at the audience of developers for JavaScript, it's just massive. And now with Node and things like that, it's growing even bigger. And I think the things like the whole view source model, the ability to just look at a page, see what code is there, learn from it, and adopt it, and then reuse it for yourself. That just makes that whole adoption cycle so much quicker. And the deployment cycle, there's no compile, test, release. It's just, you know, it's a continuous deployment model.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you, Alan, from a technical perspective, do you think that you're going to get JavaScript and this, you know, JavaScript speeds native? Do you think you're going to be able to get something that has to be run inside of a virtual machine, because JavaScript has to be run inside of a virtual machine, garbage collection, all this stuff. It's not a generational garbage collector. He's laughing. I'm asking a serious question. He's going to say he has a graph?
No, I mentioned it, yes. So what I demonstrated today in my talk, and the same demos of you might have seen, actually, you probably saw this demo at Splash, because I know you were there, which was an H, what is it, 264?
H264.
H264 video decoder running live in a browser doing real time. Actually, in the example where I was showing, it was doing faster than native frame rate rendering of video, and it was all done in JavaScript.
Okay.
And the tagline of that after I showed that was, oh, by the way, that codec was actually originally implemented in C, and the C code was compiled to JavaScript.
Yes.
Right? And so you were seeing there C code compiled to JavaScript running with real-time performance in a browser today.
Excellent. Now, I guess let me step back, though, and kind of reframe the context of my question. Remember, as you just said, the code was crafted, the code was composed, the art was written and painted in C.
Originally, yes.
Now, if you look at the JavaScript source code, and you can see that, it's the ugliest, hardest to read, unbelievable stuff you can imagine. No human will ever write that. So at some point, my question is, are you going to build, can I write that in JavaScript by hand?
Sure.
Really?
And as a matter of fact, the guys who are doing that particular Broadway project are actually, right now, they're writing an equivalent codec in pure JavaScript, not starting with C.
Okay.
And I would expect, we'll see how it turns out, but I would expect the native JavaScript version ultimately to be faster than the C version, because there's fewer layers of translation and virtualization involved in stuff.
Interesting.
Now, that kind of gets into the evolution of JavaScript, and certainly in terms of the language and things can be its expressibility and also the tools for doing JavaScript development. There's a lot of work to be done there. But JavaScript is a fine programming language. It may not be the perfect programming language, but, you know, I'm kind of finding it useful to draw comparisons between where we are now in the early ages of the PC, you know, era. And, you know, nobody ever thought the Intel processors were the, you know, were the best architecture or the highest performance architecture. There was processor wars and language wars. And, you know, ultimately, those details in the long run don't matter. As an industry, we deal with them. And what really becomes most important is what's most widely available that can do the job.
Fair enough. But I mean, in some sense, it's like we keep the now, so I'll ask you, I mean, the thing you know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like HTML5 and this push towards HTML5 is a means to democratize programming. And so that you don't have to be an expert in a domain or use a complicated tool set, complicated tool chain with multiple build steps. In other words, think about, I mean, is that part of why HTML5 is such a big deal? What's going on?
I don't think it's so much about this.
What is it then?
When you're saying democratizing, there's kind of overtones of dumbing it down for a broader audience.
No, not dumbing it down.
Yep.
Making it, not at all dumbing it down. Yep. Don't get me wrong. No, that's not what I'm saying. I want to be clear on camera.
Not being insulting. No.
I mean, seriously, I know some unbelievably talented developers. I mean, they can program circles around me and always could.
Yep.
And they're web developers.
Yep.
So, no. Yep. What I mean is, it's a conceptually broader model in the sense that more people can learn how to program an HTML5 app in a shorter period of time than you can teach yourself, say, C++ and write ATL app.
It's definitely more accessible. And there's already a larger audience. But also, so we also develop a lot of iOS and Android type applications.
And Objective-C.
Yeah, and it's just a really painful experience compared to the web development. Compiled versus interpreted, just there you have a distance because the loop between changes and then seeing the effect of that is just longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience is smaller. You're right, there is a much bigger hurdle. So, democratizing is not a bad term because it is just for a broad audience.
Sure, and I mean that's what... But I guess really my real question is, and I don't think anyone's really answered it. We keep talking about HTML5 as the future. I mean, you can build Windows 8 Metro apps in HTML5.
Yeah, I saw that the other day. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think people have said wow enough. I think that's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you how behind HTML5 Microsoft is.
Yeah.
And we know Apple is. We know Google is as well. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody is. But I'm trying to ask the question, why? What is it about HTML5 that makes it special?
It's there.
It's there.
It's there. I think that's it's ubiquitous. Mm. You know, it's everywhere. So it's the best thing that's everywhere, and it's to some degree. How did it get there? Nobody knows. You don't know exactly. Something else could have gotten there. You know, once upon a time, every browser ran Java. And Java could have been JavaScript, right?
Yeah.
But it isn't. The way the market evolved and developers chose the technology, they used HTML and JavaScript rather than applets, you know, rather than Java applets at some point in time. And I, you know, we can go back and look at maybe why they made that choice, and there's probably all sorts of reasons involved, but in the end, it kind of doesn't matter. Is the thing that became universal was the web application platform, HTML5, CSS, JavaScript. It's there, and you always have a better chance of succeeding, I think, of taking something that is already universal and building on it and extending it, rather than saying we're going to come in and we're going to displace this thing with something different, and it's going to be better, but to really cause that displacement. It has to be so much better that we probably none of us know how to create something that's enough better to...
Sure.
And by the time you've done that, so with the JavaScript performance, it's already really, really good, mm-hmm. but we've only just started down the path to optimization. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you've still got all of Moore's Law kicking in, so the speed of the processors and the GPUs over the next few years is massively increasing still. Mm. So like you were saying earlier about the performance increase, I think the hardware just sucks up any small issues that there are, but it's also improving at the software level.
Absolutely. No, and I agree. I mean, I just think it's an interesting topic because I think we often focus so much on JavaScript. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of other things that are happening in the browser.
Oh, yeah.
And the browser has the DOM,
yep.
which is a bottleneck for performance and reliability. And that stuff's going to have to be fixed as well, not just making JavaScript run faster.
Right. And of course, you know, all the DOM really is a JavaScript library. But it's a JavaScript library which historically was implemented in C++. Mm. And it wasn't really designed from the perspective of JavaScript. It's actually more designed to be like a Java or even C# style of interface to the objects and stuff. Mm. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, so one of the things in the evolution of ECMAScript were for the next version of the standard, one of our goals is so in fact that the DOM can be implemented in pure JavaScript, that you don't have to have C++ behind us. And at Mozilla, we've done some early experiments with that, and we've implemented parts of the DOM in JavaScript. And in many cases, we find that the JavaScript-based DOM is actually faster than the C++-based DOM.
Right? Interesting.
Because there's a lot of it's very expensive to go in from a dynamic language environment like JavaScript to a static language environment like C++. And so there's this tremendous cost going back and forth across those boundaries. If you just move it all into JavaScript, everything is faster.
If you move it all into JavaScript, you remove COM interop.
Right. Exactly.
And so it's really, it's I wouldn't say that C++ is the problem.
It's interop.
It's interop. It's interop with COM.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a very interesting and never-ending story. But COM is a good thing, I think. Now, interesting, man. So I want to go back a little bit to augmented reality because I think we've geeked out kind of on the sort of the platform implementation details. Can you give some more examples of how, unfortunately, I was unable to see your talk. But give me some examples of how augmented reality can be used that we haven't already addressed. So, like, what are you thinking?
Yeah, there's a bunch of demos, and so my presentation's on SlideShare, and it's got links out to a lot of the demos. So there are some things that are working in the browser now. So the Git User Media API lets you have camera and microphone access, so you can do that sort of image processing in the browser. There's some good examples. I saw a great demonstration at ISMA a couple of weeks ago of natural feature tracking inside the browser. But in terms of applications... There's a lot. Up until now, there's been very little utility in augmented reality. It's mostly been marketing hype, and I think more people have seen the YouTube videos than have actually experienced the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have found a lot of good utilities. Some of the best examples are still some of the older ones. So, like, there's a FedEx... it's a U.S. Postal Service example, where if you need to know the size of a package... to put an object in that you're going to mail, you put a marker on top, hold that in front of your camera, and it'll project the different boxes around it, and you can see which ones are fitted. And that's just useful. Mm-hmm. But there are very few examples like that. Mm. But I think as we move into having access to more of the sensor data, so before you were talking about a lot of the processing being done in the cloud, mm-hmm. I think that's definitely a huge move, and that's definitely happening. Mm. But Alan made an interesting point that a lot of it will be also more of a more distributed, more mesh model. Mm. So there's lots of devices talking around you as well, not just in the network. And so I think those things, devices that are aware of you as you move past and being able to track things, mm-hmm. that'll open up a whole...
Well, I mean, with you, one of the products that Microsoft has released recently is the Kinect. Sensor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, you know, people always talk about its image processing capabilities, but it also has a rather amazing audio system on it.
Yeah.
And that could, I could see how you can have multiple connect devices around your house in various places.
Absolutely.
And you will just be, that. There's your ambient understanding of what you're doing.
There's at ISMA, I saw a great demo from Microsoft of Kinect Fusion, and so it's definitely worth Googling that. There's some great videos around that. So dynamic 3D model generation, but that dynamic models that you can manipulate as they're being created and then throw other 3D objects into them as well. So the Kinect and any of those RGBD sort of cameras that have depth awareness, it's now more like a 3D painting environment. At the moment, the cost of creating 3D assets is quite high, but that just changes it completely. And then at the moment, a lot of the compute power in the computer vision side of AR is around taking a 2D plane image and trying to guess what shapes are in it. Once you have depth information, that takes a lot of the cognitive load off the software. It can then just go, I know this shape is here. I know this person's interaction is here.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. And we'll be programming that with HTML5 if Alan is right.
A lot of it, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right on, man.
You know, I was sitting here looking at your video setup in front of me, your video setup here, and you have a very nice professional, video camera here, but it's just sort of sitting there statically, and you have to be back there just in case you need to tweak something. Well, I don't see any reason why in a few years you can't just be sitting here with us, and your camera here is being a reasonable video operator and video director, focusing in on the speaker and panning as appropriate and doing much of that processing right locally, and some stuff maybe up in the cloud, but really, that's a big camera. You can have a whole cloud inside that camera there,
Absolutely.
And a lot of intelligence. Yeah.
I agree, and it would be nice because then, when people would say, should I look at you or look at the camera, I'd say, well, the camera's actually going to ask you some questions. So you can talk to the camera when it asks you.
Well, I think I'd have you ask the question.
No.
That's what you get, good at.
The humans are good, but this is interesting, and I'm glad. I think this is the first time that the camera got to be part of the conversation. thank you for doing that, man.
There's a short video I showed in my prayers. There's a documentary maker from Canada called Rob Spence.
Okay.
He lost one of his eyes, and he's built a team to create a wireless camera that's inserted as a prosthetic. And he's making a documentary that's shot mostly through his eye.
Wow.
So from a camera perspective, I think that's fascinating.
That is very, very interesting. Mm. Right on, man. Well, from these eyes to yours, thank you for coming on. And I'm really interested to see what goes on with augmented reality. I know Alan's doing some crazy things, and we'll see how this all works out.
Okay.
And we'll talk about it again.
Okay, thanks.
Cheers, man.
Okay, bye.
Yow rocks.